Very grateful for these readings. Very grateful for the way in which we've been able to worship under the leadership of our musicians, under Simon. And now as we come to a little message for today, we're turning then to where we just had our second reading, John 19. So good morning, everybody. And with just a week to go before Easter Day, when Stephen Sizer will be bringing to us the last of 20 years' worth of his sermons preached here. It's my privilege at his gracious invitation once more to open up Holy Week for us all as we think together of all that happened from Christ's triumphant entry into Jerusalem on that first Palm Sunday right through to those solemn events that Pam had just read about on Good Friday. We'll be hearing Stephen when he leads us both this coming Thursday evening as well as on Good Friday itself, and we shall look forward very much to that opportunity together. Seeing that only about 3 weeks ago I was preaching on the Matthew's Gospel account of Palm Sunday, I think the right thing for me today this morning is to project our minds onward a little, then from that first reading in Luke 19 to John's Gospel now, in what I might call a preview of some of the currents and motives that would later swirl around the events of that Holy Week as a kind of preparation again for our exposure to Stephen's ministry in a few days' time. So John chapter 19, that's page 1087, and first to verse 5. When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." Then again, Pilate, at the end of verse 14, "Here is your king." Here, friends, in John 18 and 19, we're faced with a piece of legal injustice, so wicked that it led eventually to the enshrining of Pilate's name in Christian creeds. As we said this morning, that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, recited by millions all over the world. The creeds alone ensured that the name of this grubby Roman provincial governor would become just about the second best known name in all of history. And simply because for a few fateful hours, he had come face to face with Jesus Christ, the carpenter preacher, by whose dating the entire calendar of our very civilization has been fixed. As for the witnesses for the prosecution, well, looking at the passage, it looked like a victory for their cause when Pilate finally wound up the case and handed the prisoner over to be crucified. To the words, "Here is your king," the chief priests had shot back, "We have no king but Caesar." And by that last throw of desperation on their part, they had, in a kind of legally constituted court, surrendered Israel's age-long prophetic claim to be ruled only by God. The victory of these religious leaders would eventually prove suicidal when the Romans and their sovereign rule that they shouted for would finally crush the temple and their country in AD 70. A historical event so terrible that its very anticipation had, as we read earlier, caused Jesus to weep there in Jerusalem on that Palm Sunday. We could rightly give this study of John 19 the title of Power Play. So in the week that changed the world, the question raises itself, who had the real power? On the physical level, naturally, we could argue that it lay in the hands of the Roman military. Perhaps that's the opening category in this Power Play saga that we can identify here. Let's describe it then, first simply as raw power, naked, raw power, which had relied on the betrayal by Judas and the physical arrest of chapter 18, on the payment of money, on an amassing of opposition, and on the assembling of an arsenal of torches, lanterns, and weapons. History would ask, is that the secret of real enduring power? Many belief systems and even religions believe that it is. That if you pour out enough petrodollars, issue enough threats, exert sufficient force, step up the propaganda to saturation point, you can gain your ends. No. The exercising of raw power to make your point is only an admission that you've lost the argument. Raw power? Here in John's Gospel, the imperial soldiery plays its own part, but it doesn't take much for us to recognize that the soldiers played, really when you think of it, the minor role in all that was taking place. Verse 1 here, Jesus has just been beaten in the Roman style. It was often so severe that it could kill the prisoner even before the crucifixion that it preceded. Then followed in verses 2 and 3, the traditional game of the king, as it was known as. If today you visit in Jerusalem the convent of the Sisters of Zion, they will take you below ground level to what archaeologists have firmly established as the very pavement where what was called the game of the king was gruesomely played out with prisoners, any prisoner of Rome. You can see even today the scratchings that the soldiers used to draw on the pavement square. I've seen them. One square on it is marked to the Greek letter beta, B for Basileus, king. So Jesus wasn't the only prisoner that game was played with. But of course the controversy about him as king of the Jews gave an extra twist to the proceedings that day. No doubt it was the purple robe that Herod had laughingly dressed Jesus in. There was now, after the beating, once more put onto the Lord as this mock coronation took place with its "Hail, King of the Jews," together with the thorns, the laughs, and the blows in the face. We'll be thinking about that on Good Friday. It makes us wince now, but that's all part of any regime that lies on force. And here is God in human form, subjecting himself to its full rigors, like, well, I suppose, any of the 60 million slaves that labored in the Roman Empire. Raw power. It wasn't the deciding factor in the story of that day, but it does tell us that the pain was real, that the incarnation of Jesus as a human being was no play acting, and that your forgiveness and mine wasn't pronounced from a remote kind of ethereal throne from on high, or an armchair, or from a professor's lectern. No. It happened through pain and blood and fists and sticks and nails, all in the heat and the flies and the thirst of a particular day in a particular city. That's what we learn in the exercising here of raw power. Secondly, though, we can recognize here the force of what I will call vested power. That is, the religious twistings and political maneuverings, or the vested interests represented in the trial and death of Jesus. Caiaphas, the high priest, is there with his own religious hierarchy, and members of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling body, in the power play that was taking place. Pontius Pilate, in verse 4, brings out the prisoner, knowing his innocence, to save him if he can. All in all, you know, you read here, he brings him out 5 times. He'd already authorized the illegal beating in a vague hope that this might satisfy the vindictive desires of the religious authorities. But his statement, "Here is the man," only results in an animal roar. Not from the common people, whose hearts had been won by the words and stories and healings that had changed life after life. No, ironically, it was the supposedly revered leaders of church and state who were personifying the devil, albeit wearing a clergyman's collar. Their stranglehold on religious life had been so challenged by the man of Galilee that by verse 14, their chanting had become frenzied. "Take him away, crucify him." I was reading the published thoughts of the 17th century French Christian philosopher Blaise Pascal. Let me quote from him. "Men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction." That's on page 265. May God save us in today's world from such terrible travesty of religion. Just as raw power in the soldiery was part of the events of Holy Week, so was vested power in the hierarchy. But then, in the person of Pontius Pilate himself, we can't avoid recognizing what we can only call token power. Token power. If the chief priest's power play is marked by plain wickedness, that of Pontius Pilate was characterized by sheer weakness. We know a fair amount about Pontius Pilate from the Roman historian Tacitus and the Jewish writer Josephus. Pilate, who was put in charge of Judea in the year 26 AD, was extremely unpopular with the Jews, with his reputation for scandals and bloodshed, and he was desperate to stay in the favor of the emperor Tiberius. It was in AD 37 that Pilate was ordered to report to Rome over accusations made against him. We don't know the exact result of the trial, but Greek historians relate that he was forced to commit suicide during the reign of Gaius Caesar. I think of Pilate then in terms of token power, because by the time of Christ's trial, the Jews knew his character all too well, and the religious leaders counted on it. So it's with confidence that they say here in verse 12, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Pilate is desperate to stay out of trouble. 3 times in these 2 chapters, he's recorded as saying that he finds no basis for a charge against Jesus. He goes so far as saying, as we heard earlier, "You take him and crucify him." Naturally, the Jews knew that they had no authority to carry out executions. But they also knew enough of Pilate's weakness to trade on them, recognizing in all his misjudgments over the years that his power had eroded to the point of tokenism. Nominally, yes, he was in charge. But with clever manipulation, events could be made to move out of his control. Pilate is twisting and turning. It's the other gospel writers who record Jesus being sent to Herod with no result. At the end of chapter 18, the offer of Jesus had been made as one of 2 specially chosen prisoners. Remember the story? One of 2 special prisoners could be released at that time of year according to a traditional custom. But no, the colorful rogue Barabbas is chosen, and the net is closing in for Pilate. True, here in verse 13, he's sitting in the judge's seat of power to deliver his verdict. But all the time, the verdict is being pronounced on him. And Christ's words to him are ominously true in verse 11. You would have no power over me if it were not given you from above. Here's the Bible's supreme example of puppet-like power. This was power play. Raw power, vested power, now in Pilate, token power. We close off our brief study with a look at Jesus himself. I can only call this silent power. Earlier, the Lord had answered questions put to him, but it's at verses 8 and 9 of our chapter that Jesus gives no answer, just as he had done earlier with Herod, who had longed to see a miracle from the carpenter preacher. But Christ had remained silent before him. I think it's true to say, must be true, that there comes a point in a person's life when, having had every chance to follow God's way, God has no more to say to them. It happened to Pharaoh back in the Old Testament, king of Egypt, centuries earlier, when, having hardened his heart repeatedly against the warnings of Moses, God had no more to say. It happened to King Saul of old, having shut down on the claims of David, his heir. It happened to King Ahab in his continued refusal of the prophet Elijah. Now it's happened to Pontius Pilate. It seems that just about the hardest people ever to turn in faith to Jesus Christ are those who, having heard his claims upon them, time without number, stay unmoved. Or if they hear them, they will simply say, I've heard all that before. I got it at Sunday school. I knew all that. I suppose it's part of divine judgment that at a certain point, heaven goes silent on a person. And the day of grace, even in this life, can be taken away. Here in John's Gospel, from now on, apart from his words on the cross, Jesus has no more to say to his accusers. Here was silent power, which, if a man or woman won't respond to it, will leave us in the end, like Pilate, in the prison of our own self-preservation. Again we ask, why silent power? The answer is, at the cross, where Jesus died in substitutional, sacrificial love for our forgiveness, the cross has no further words to prop up its message. One look at the cross, and that's enough to demand my soul, my life, my all. I've sometimes told stories from East Africa, where I grew up. As I close, I make no apology for telling this one from the 1970s. One of the best friends our family ever had was an evangelist from Uganda. You can see his picture on the screen there. Festo Kivenjeri. He eventually became a mighty bishop. Then came the time of an evil madman, Uganda's murderous president for life, as he called himself, General Idi Amin. And we put his picture on the screen. Thousands died in his torture house in Kampala. I've seen that building. Then came the shooting by Amin himself of Uganda's saintly Anglican Archbishop Janani Luwum, Festo's best friend. The news headlines went worldwide. Those in the know urged Festo, hey, you're next on the list. Please, for our sakes, leave the country and come back another day when all this is over. Now go. Go tonight. Festo Kivenjeri and his dear wife, Mira, You can see them pictured here. They left their home and everything in it that very night. Holding one suitcase each, they went out by foot over the mountains and kept on walking until they were out of Uganda. Help was provided in getting them to England eventually, where first they would eventually set up a Help for Uganda organization over here. But their first stopping off point in England was the Good Friday service being held in London's All Souls Church. And sitting in that service, as Pastor later declared, he said, "My heart was seething with resentment and rage against General Amin, who had killed my best friend, the Archbishop. That hate overtook me in that service. But," he said, "as once again we were introduced to the story of the cross, I sensed Jesus speaking to me." He put the picture there of Skull Hill on the screen, which is where Jesus was crucified. And Festo said, "Jesus seemed to be saying to me, 'Festo, supposing General Amin had been one of the soldiers laughing and gambling for my clothes when I was dying there on the cross, do you think I would have prayed, Father, forgive them all, oh, except that one? Come back to the cross yourself, Festo. Change your thoughts towards Idi Amin." In that very service, Festo Kavenjeri did so. And as he told me later, "I can now write my next book. I'm going to call it, I Love Idi Amin." See, I got the picture there. Here's the little book. I got it myself. I said to the bishop, "Oh, Festo, how can you ever write that book?" "I can," he said, "I can. The cross has such power that even Amin is redeemable." Well, that became the name of the little book. That's what the silent power of Jesus does to a person. We only need to approach the cross ourselves and take in afresh what Christ has done for us by his saving blood. And prejudices and hatreds and jealousies, resentments, inevitably, they take a back seat. One look, they're gone. Raw power, vested power, yes, token power like Pilate's, all become disempowered when the silent power, so evident during that week, captures our hearts. With Holy Week now on top of us, feel free at the close of this service to ask us for a little card. We've had printed one or two cards here of response to the cross of Christ. And I, or Simon, or Naomi sitting next to him, or Pam, we'll give you one of these cards if you ask us for one, which you can use as a sort of Holy Week preparation for Good Friday and Easter Day, next weekend, when Stephen Sizer, our long-enduring dear friend and vicar, brings us his special messages. The cross and resurrection will lead us all to a fresh love of God in Jesus Christ. Years ago, it was the famous Danish thinker Søren Kierkegaard who wrote, "A believer is surely a lover. Yea, of all lovers, the most in love."